Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the show. The best in paranormal talk radio is on the air. This is Beyond the Darkness. And because the Legion of Army of Darkness has cried out for it, we've heard your cries, folks. We know what you want on this show. And being the guys that we are, Tim and Dave, we've put it together for you, a special edition. This is True Crime Tuesday on Beyond the Darkness, our first installment. Now, this is important. Make sure you download this show and listen to the show, rate and review the show. Let them know that you like it by downloading the show often and sharing it with as many people as you can that may not be as so into the paranormal aspects of the show, but like true crime, make sure you share the show so we can continue to grow it. Our hope is to extend the show to 6 episodes a week, our 5 regular paranormal episodes, and every Tuesday, a True Crime Tuesday installment. That's what's going on tonight. For a quick look at the rest of the week, Wednesday, we have A Paranormal Life, The Good, The Bad, and The Aliens. MJ Myers joins us to talk about her story. Thursday, Savannah Haunts. We're going to look at some Southern scares in Savannah, Georgia. And then on Friday, The Extra Dimensionals, True Tales of Alien Visitors. John D'Souza, a former FBI investigator, is going to be here with us. And we've got a brand new Theater of the Mind. It's an alien encounter story, a true alien encounter story from Tim Haas. So you're going to want to make sure to tune in for that. That's what's on tap this week. Tonight, we're going to dip back into the world of true crime. And a little later on in the show, we're going to go back to dumb crimes, stupid criminals, take a look at what our good friend Florida Man has been up to since we've taken this little hiatus. And I'll be joined this evening by Jason Gowan, a good friend of the show. And you might recognize him from shows like Extreme Paranormal. He's got a couple of new projects in the works and has been a guest on our show on numerous occasions. He's also an Amityville horror expert, but he's going to join me for some dumb crime, stupid criminals later on tonight. You had a chance to listen to him and hanging out with us last night on our Parashare and Supernatural News Monday. He'll be back again in a little bit tonight to have some more fun. But let's get started. Our guest joining us this evening has been with us before on Darkness Radio. This is her first time to visit us on Beyond the Darkness. Catherine Casey is an award-winning journalist who's written for Rolling Stone, TV Guide, Reader's Digest, Texas Monthly, and many other publications. She's the author of 7 previous true crime books and the creator of the highly acclaimed Sarah Armstrong mystery series. Casey has also appeared on Oprah, Oprah Winfrey's Oxygen Network, Biography, Nancy Grace, E! Network, True TV, Investigation Discovery, and Travel Channel, and A&E. She lives in Houston with her husband and their dog, Nelson. She's here to talk to us tonight about a case that we knew would be perfect for our show. The book is called Possessed, The Infamous Texas Stiletto Murder. Welcome to the show, Catherine Casey. Thank you so much for being here this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure. Boy, this is what an interesting story. Let's give people a little bit of background on this, and we'll flesh out the entire tale as the show progresses here. But how do you go about picking which stories you want to cover when you decide to tackle a new true crime book, Catherine?
Well, I look for something that's unusual, something with a lot of twists and turns, something that I'm interested in. I think if it'll hold my interest, it holds the interest of the readers. This book hit in a lot of different areas, this case.
Yeah, this is definitely one that has twists and turns. I mean, this sounds like something that would have come out of a Hollywood movie, right? I mean, this almost sounds too unreal to be true.
Well, I mean, can't you picture some of it? Anna Trujillo and her devil worship and the pentagrams and the chanting. And at the same time, you know, this beautiful woman with these stiletto heels. I mean, it just really had everything going for it.
All right. In this case now, and it's titled Possessed, let's start to learn a little bit about the players involved in the story. And let's start off with our victim. What can you tell us about this man? Who was he? What was his life like prior to meeting Anna?
Stefan Anderson was a professor at the University of Houston. He was a brilliant man. He worked as a research scientist. He lectured to medical students. He worked on hormones. When this happened, he was working on a study involving hormones and premature births. So this is somebody who's very bright. He moved to Houston from Dallas. He moved to Dallas from his native country, which was Sweden. He had kind of a tumultuous childhood. and his father had been abusive toward his mother. And he had turned into this very gentle man. He saw himself as the antithesis of his father.
And his life prior to meeting Anna, had he been married before? Did he have children? What was he like in that situation?
Stefan was married at one point. He married in Dallas and then lived in New York for a while working for a pharmaceutical company. And the marriage only lasted a few years. They kind of drifted apart. Part of the problem, Stefan did have a problem with alcohol, and he would spend evenings kind of, as you know, some people do, sitting in pubs. And the marriage just really, they just had two different lives, two separate lives. He always wanted children. He always wanted a marriage, always wanted a good family life. But despite all of his other gifts, this is something that he just never got. He never achieved it.
Was there ever, in Stefan's life, was there ever a history of violence? Did he ever act out, especially when drunk, or act threatening towards his ex-wife?
No, actually the opposite was true. Stefan had a tendency when he would drink to become even more, even calmer. And he, there were instances, like there was an instance in a bar one night where he'd said something to a woman and she became angry and went to hit him. And all he did was turn away. I talked with his former girlfriends and they told me that he was always exceedingly gentle with them.
And there was no red flags in this guy's life at all that you were able to dig up? Anything that showed that there might be some kind of extreme personality disorder or violent tendencies at all?
Nothing. He just wasn't that guy. That's not who Stefan was. He just really didn't believe in violence. And after having watched his mother suffer as she had during his childhood and not being able to protect her, He often told people that he would never be his father, and he swore he would never hit a woman.
Well, that's good. I mean, we've got a decent man here, good background, good upbringing in spite of the negativity that he had in his life, and obviously a smart man. Now, Anna, and how do you say her last name, Trio?
Anna Trujillo.
Anna Trujillo. Okay, and what can you tell me about her life before coming together with Stefan?
Well, she had actually a pretty good job. She'd grown up in kind of a tumultuous situation. Her father had left the family when they were young. She had three brothers and sisters, and the mom worked, so Anna had to help. And she was rather resentful of that because she felt like she had lost her childhood taking care of her siblings. But she'd done well. She did well in school. She married young and had two daughters. That marriage fell apart. She claimed that her first husband sexually assaulted her at one point after they had separated. But she had a good job. She seemed really stable. She worked for Coca-Cola as a merchandising person, and she had a lot of responsibilities. She had a corporate car. She won company contests and had all kinds of Coke memorabilia from her work. She was well-liked. She was very pretty. And she was vivacious. People just were charmed by Anna Trujillo. She's one of those people, Dave, you know, who, like in a party, will kind of take the time to go up to people and talk to them and really seem interested in their lives.
So she, very gregarious personality, very open, and certainly an interesting background. Now, let's start to talk about the paranormal aspect. Did this play a part in her life before meeting Stefan?
She was intrigued. Starting when she was very young, she was interested in things like Ouija boards, and she talked about the spiritual thing. And it was just kind of there as an interest in her life. And then when she was married to her second husband, he would come home and find that she'd been playing around with a Ouija board or doing like chants, that type of thing. And the neighbors noticed odd things. There was a very nice young couple living next door with a couple of little girls. And the dad noticed things like one night when he walked to the mailbox past the Anna's house, he looked up and he thought he saw almost a goblin on the roof. He looked back a couple of times and thought that it was there. And then he looked back, I think it was the third time, and it had disappeared. For some reason, Anna's house was the one in the neighborhood where the crows would congregate on the roof, which he thought was very odd at the time.
Yeah.
When he, yeah, it's
that
strange.
Sounds creepy, yeah.
So, when she moved into Houston, it escalated. When she moved into downtown Houston, things just started really taking off. She left her second husband and got, well, she was working, she opened a massage studio.
Well, let me ask you one thing, Catherine. When she would be walked in on playing with the Ouija board or chanting, did they have any idea what was she doing? Would she ever explain? Was she trying to curse somebody? Was she just calling on spirits? What was the what was going on to bring her to this point?
You know, she didn't explain that. It was just that she was very interested. And the husband, first, you know, her parents and later her husband would tell her to put it away, ask her to stop. Her second husband was very Christian, and he saw it as an affront or a sin, and he didn't want it happening in the house. So they would have words over it, and she would stop. And I think it was part of what led to the divorce. And then, Dave, she became this masseuse in downtown Houston, and she was living in the old Rice Hotel. And the Rice has the reputation of being one of the haunted spots in Houston. And in the Rice, Anna was doing the same things. She was late at night. She'd come home from the bars, and she was playing with her Ouija board.
And again, the friends and relatives that would speak about this and witness her doing it, would she play the board alone? Did she have somebody else she was involved with on this? And who was she trying to communicate with?
She was just communicating with spirits. She would sometimes have friends with her. Sometimes she talked about what she was doing. She started showing up at parties, and instead of cornering people and asking about their lives and talking about them the way that she had in the past, she would start talking about her beliefs. And she started to think that she had paranormal or spiritual beliefs. She thought that she could lay hands on someone and cure them. She thought that she could feel sickness in people's bodies. She had this exaggerated opinion of her own powers. She started talking about her powers all the time. Mm. And then she went to New Orleans, and she came back with a voodoo doll. She had this little voodoo doll in a wooden casket that she carried around to the bars in Houston. She hung out a lot in the evenings, but at night in the bars. She was dating a lot of men. But at times, she would take out this voodoo doll and walk up and rub it on people and start, if she was angry with them, and start mumbling in Spanish. And sometimes she would cut pieces of their hair or find something of theirs to take with her if she became angry.
Yikes. So she definitely had kind of a dark side starting to brew. Was she pulling into herself? Did people say, was she having a major personality shift and change?
You know, she started doing unusual things. She was drinking more, so she got picked up on a couple of DWIs here in Houston. One time, going the wrong way on one of the major freeways. And she just became odder and odder. But she was still the same Anna during the day and most of the time. But then every once in a while she would bring up her beliefs. She was going to Herberias. Do you know what those are, the stores?
No, I'm not familiar.
Well, we have Herberias here in Houston, and a lot of them are patronized by people who are of, you know, Hispanic heritage, and they have many types of herbs that they sell. For different purposes, you can go in and buy like an herb to make or a candle to burn to make money, an herb that'll cure any problem with your liver, different things like that. They'll often have a mixture of Christian symbols like statues of the Virgin Mary inside, along with things like a voodoo doll. It's just a kind of a coming together of cultures. And so she started going there and taking friends with her. Some of them became just incredibly freaked out and left. You know, it was they did see changes in her. She, you know, she did become more vocal, and she became more aggressive. She was starting to do things in the bars, like if the waitress didn't respond the way she wanted her to, she once threw a drink at a waitress. She slapped a busboy one night in a bar. But still, the managers at the bar didn't tell her she couldn't come back because everybody liked Donna. And she would bring flowers and roses and give them to the men, and she would dance on the dance floor. And she was a very pretty woman.
All right, when do these worlds collide? At what point does Anna meet Stefan, and how do they get together?
In the fall of 2012, Anna was living in a beautiful condominium, not in the penthouse, but on the 21st floor of a beautiful high-rise condominium near Herman Park, which is a very pretty part of our city. And with a man. She had gotten to the point where she was going from one man to the next, living with different men. And Stefan Anderson had an apartment in that building. He'd been there for a little over a year at that point. And they met in the lobby. And they started talking. And she was this beautiful woman in stiletto heels. Stefan loved stiletto heels. And they decided to go out for dinner. And within days, Stefan was talking about Anna and telling his friends. And the next thing they heard, which was within a week or so, was that she had moved in with him.
Wow. All right. Well, love is curious, right? It has its ways. She was still living with this other guy. Did she move out of his and go directly to start living with Stefan?
She did. At that point in Anna's life, she was, for the most part, homeless in a way, but she never lived on the streets or anything. But she just went from one person to the next. Sometimes they were just friends, and they'd let her stay for a short period of time. Very often they were men she was having affairs with.
Now, was she telling Stefan that she was being mistreated and abused? Was the hero complex maybe what helped push him to do this a little quicker than he normally would have?
No, I think he was just enthralled with her. He sounded enchanted with her. He started talking about, he was very lonely. He had a lot of friends, but he was still kind of a lonely man, and he was still kind of looking for that woman. And he had talked about finding a Latino woman who would teach him how to salsa dance. And, you know, she was just kind of enchanting, and he was very excited about her. He talked about being in love with her in the beginning and wanting to marry her. And then things started to change, and before long, it wasn't at all what he had anticipated.
How long did it take for this transition to begin?
Not long, probably 6 or 7 weeks. First, he started complaining. He was working on a research project, and he was complaining that he couldn't get his work done because she was always interrupting, wanting him to dance with her in the apartment or take pictures of her. There were tons of photos of her and video of her on his phone that he had done. And then a really strange thing happened one night over at the Park Lane in the apartment on the 18th floor. He called down and said that he needed somebody to come up, that there was water pouring out of the refrigerator. And they got up there, and Anna had cut, in the middle of the night, Anna had cut the water line going into the refrigerator, and water was pouring out. And she sat back and laughed while they tried to stop it. And when he asked why she had done that, she said that the refrigerator was talking to her, and she could hear it, and she was trying to make it stop.
Okay, so now we're starting to see the fracture of reality seeping in. Before, it was just a fascination with the strange and the supernatural. Now the refrigerator is speaking to her, and what she thought by cutting the water line, that was going to kill it? Or
I guess so. I guess she was trying to silence it. She was also doing other odd things, like she was writing. She would take pieces of paper and draw circle after circle after circle after circle on them, and little snatches of words. And she thought that this was some great work of art, that she had this incredible talent. And it was really just scribbles on a sheet of paper.
Now, did she have any, I mean, in her family, was there a history of mental illness? And, you know, did it affect her daughters as well?
No, there wasn't any. And Anna was in her 40s at that point, which is really rather late to start presenting with something like this. So she was not diagnosed with any. She did go to doctors, but she was never diagnosed with any mental illness.
With that said, then, you've got a woman who went from pretty normal, very popular, very likable, happy person to starting to have delusions and issues. And he's seeing this within a 6-week change. Is he familiar during any of this of her enchantment with the supernatural and the paranormal?
Well, he was. But Stefan was an atheist, as many scientists are. And he kind of humored all of it. He didn't see it as being, you know, a problem in the beginning. In fact, he told one person that Anna had been up during in the middle of the night doing voodoo. And he didn't see it as, he was always Stefan was always rather intrigued with people who were different. And he was always rather intrigued by other people's ideas. So he would talk about it, but he didn't seem concerned about it in the beginning. But after the episode with the refrigerator, people started to warn him that there was something not right with Anna, that there was something going on.
Well, did it take? He's a scientist at this point. Is he not figuring that out on his own? He's got to have his friends step up and go, hey, you know, if she's talking to the fridge and trying to kill it by cutting the water line, she might have a problem.
Well, you know, on one hand, she's doing that, and on the other hand, she's catering to him and telling him how much she loves him and saying that they're going to get married and taking him home to meet her very nice parents and her daughters and talking about how they're going to be a family. I'm sure she was telling him that I can change, I can be everything you want. People can be very persuasive, Dave.
Yeah, that I'm aware of. All right, so she's making her mark, although there's some oddities about her. She's quirky, she's beautiful, she's catering to his interests and needs on other levels, I'm sure sexual and and egotistically and kind of making him feel good about his choice to be with her. Are there fights breaking out between the two of them? Do people start hearing issues or screams, anything going on as they're getting together?
After that October event, Stefan started to try to pull away. And from there, then through, I think it was about February or so, they would have arguments. And he would tell his friends that he needed to end it. He realized that he needed to end it by about November or December. He actually went down repeatedly and revoked her right to get into his apartment. And he seemed a little bit afraid of her, especially by the beginning of the next year after January of 2013. He started to talk about things like, well, you know, she gets a little rough sometimes. Some of his friends thought that he was talking about during sex and that he kind of maybe liked that. But it turned out that he was actually talking about her being quite... you know, not abusive at that point maybe, but physical with him. And Stefan was an older gentleman. He was quite a bit older than she was. He was in his late 50s. He was 59 years old in January, March of that year. And she was a younger woman, and she was quite strong. So he started to act rather concerned about things, but not terribly in the beginning. But then as the months went on, it got worse and worse.
How was his drinking at this point? Was he amping it up? Were neighbors or friends, relatives starting to realize that Stefan was amping his game up too?
No, you know, he wasn't, it wasn't over the top. He had actually been more of a drinker in the past. He had gone through a treatment program in around 2012, and he was drinking, but not as much as he used to. So that didn't, it, I mean, Stefan always drank, but, and I'm sure that he was an alcoholic, but he was never out of control. That wasn't part of his personality. So that really didn't enter into all of this. But he would go out with friends. He had this circle of friends here in Houston. And during the times when she wasn't living with him, when he kicked her out, she would show up at the bars. He was kind of a creature of habit, Dave, where he went to the same places all the time. And he met his same circle of friends, you know, kind of like a Cheers situation.
Oh, okay, and, sure.
Yeah, and she would just show up. And expect him to pay for her drinks, which he did. And then he started kind of hiding. He'd say to his friends, if Anna comes in, let me know and I'll go hide and don't tell her I'm here. And then he said to one friend that Anna had come up behind him with a, you know, and put her hands around his neck and started to squeeze. And he had broken away. So the violence was escalating. And she was drinking more. She was drinking considerably more as time went on.
Very weird twists to this relationship. And he was watching this kind of unfold, but was still somewhat enamored with her, even as she's getting more aggressive. Why, if he is afraid of the situation, why isn't he just bailing out and, you know, moving her out of the place? Any indication or idea of why he would stay in this long?
I think by the spring of 2013, he was ready to get away from her. He just didn't want her around. At the same time, he had a really hard time telling anybody no, and especially somebody that he had once loved. And Anna, he knew, needed help. Quite a few people said, well, just go away from her, just leave her alone. And he'd say things like, well, if I turn my back on her, who'll take care of her? And there was just this feeling that he wanted to go away. He wanted her not to be part of his life anymore. But he just couldn't, you know, walk away and let happen what it appeared was happening, which was that she was totally falling apart.
All right. You've got the ball in motion here. We can see the fractures in this already strange relationship. And both have their own difficulties, right? I mean, he's obviously codependent because he's staying in this kind of weird situation and wants to be there to help her, even though he really owes her nothing this short of a period of time into a relationship. She needs him for some reason. Are past men in her life reporting back that she would start acting chaotically like this as well, or was this a whole new level of crazy she was entering?
This was a new level. She had a history of becoming violent and becoming kind of histrionic in relationships, but this was a whole new level. This had escalated to this point. She started talking, well, this goes back a little bit, but in the fall of 2012, remember when the Mayan calendar was running out and everybody was talking about the world?
I remember when the world stopped. That was crazy, Catherine. I can't believe how the world just exploded on December 21st. Yeah, that was horrible.
I know. Isn't it crazy? But she got really into that. She was just getting more and more into the whole spiritual thing. And, you know, she just really was kind of falling apart.
Okay, well, there has to be a final breaking point, a tipping point that sends this relationship over the edge. How long into this relationship are they when this murder occurs?
It was about 7 months. It was May. Things started to really wind up at the end of May around Memorial Day weekend in 2013. He had kicked her out, and this time he wouldn't let her back in. And she was staying with another couple, and then unprovoked, went up and bit, actually, on the top of the head, the man she was staying with, and got into a fight with a woman and showed up at Stefan's apartment very badly beaten. Aunt Anna had bruises all over her body. They covered her face. Her chin was all swollen. It was really terrible. And Stefan, again, ran and let her move back into the house, into the apartment. But the agreement was just long enough to get better. And, he was going to send her up to Waco to live with her parents.
Where did this beating come from? Was it the people she was living with after she attacked them? They fended her off?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
Have they called the police on this couple to report this abuse and this beating, or have they just let it be?
Stefan did, and he took her to the hospital, and they reported it there. But when they went out and talked to the couple, they found out that they were just acting in response to what Anna had done. So no charges were filed.
Okay, do the police report that back to Stefan?
You know, I don't believe so.
Ooh.
I don't know that for sure, but I don't believe so. But it didn't go anywhere, and Anna was supposed to be leaving. She was supposed to go up to Waco, and she was supposed to be out of his life. He was dating someone else by then. He was seeing another woman, and he was telling his friends that he just couldn't wait for Anna to go ahead and go to Waco to be with her parents. But the night before that was supposed to happen, the next morning, there was a delay getting her up to Waco, and they ended up spending one last night together. And that's when everything happened.
All right. Now, walk us through this. What was the delay that caused them to delay this trip one more day?
Anna was supposed to be driving to Waco with another woman, and it turned out that there wasn't room in the car for her that night. So they'd made arrangements for her to go at 7 o'clock the next morning. So instead of her being gone that evening, Stefan took her out to dinner and to a place called Bar 5015 here in Houston. It's kind of an edgy place near, right outside the downtown, not far from his apartment. It was one of Anna's favorites. And they spent the evening there. Stefan sat at the bar and drank, had some wine and drank and talked to people. And Anna drank and flirted and walked around from one man to the next, and at one point was dancing in the bar stool and just having a wonderful time. And then Stefan tried to get her to leave. He called a cab to leave, and she didn't want to go, and the bar was closing, and he kept trying to get her out the door, and she didn't want to go, and he finally got her into a cab, and then she got into an argument with the cab driver on the way back and became really abusive on the way to the apartment. And it got so bad that the cab driver threatened to call the police. And at the apartment, Anna went storming into the lobby of this very posh apartment building. And the cab driver was so upset about what had happened that she took Stefan's hands and said, "Can I pray with you?" And Stefan, as I said, is an atheist, but he honored other people's beliefs. And so she held his hands and prayed. And then she said to him, "I'm worried about you. You need to get away from her." And Stefan said, "I'll be okay, but thank you." And he walked back into the building and walked across the lobby and got in the elevator and went up to the 18th floor.
All right, here's the crescendo, right? This is when everything comes together. He goes up to the 18th floor. He's already had this kind of precursor that this night is not going to end well for anyone. But he still felt like he had control, right? Like he was still strong enough to take care of himself, see this thing through till the morning, get her out of the house, and have his life back.
I think this was possibly at the point where he told her that this was really over. He'd been so embarrassed in the cab that with what she had done, that I think he was at the point where he was just exasperated and he realized that it had to end. And they got up there, and that was about 2 o'clock, a little after 2 in the morning. And about 2:15, this is a very solidly built apartment building. And about 2:15, the woman in the next apartment, the wall shook between their two apartments, and she heard banging, and it sounded like they were moving furniture. And then she heard somebody, somebody shouting, and she threw on her robe to go over there and knock on the door and complain, but then hesitated, and the voices died down, and it got quiet, and she went back to bed. And all was quiet until about 3:30 that morning, when Anna called 911 sobbing and saying that she had been attacked and that her fiancé had, had been beating her up and that she needed help and that they needed to send an ambulance. And then she said, "He's dying." And the 911 operator said, "What do you mean he's dying?" And she said, "He's dying." So they sent an ambulance and they sent a patrolman, and the patrolman knocked on the door. And Anna opened the door, and she was covered in blood. She had blood on her hands, on her face, all over her clothes. The legs of her jeans were actually saturated with blood. And when they walked in, they found Stefan's body laying on his back with blood surrounding him, blood spatter on three walls surrounding him, and a pool of blood near his head. And Anna's blue suede stiletto heel just a little bit above his head laying on the carpet. And that was covered in blood as well.
So she physically beat this man to death with a stiletto shoe.
She did. This is, I've been writing crime, I'm writing about crime cases since the 1980s. So it's 30 years. And this is among the most gruesome scenes I've ever seen. These pictures, the crime scene photos were some of the grisliest I've ever encountered. It was just this horrific scene.
All right. Obviously, everybody wants to know the possessed angle on this case. Is this woman dealing with the supernatural? Did that drive her to this end? Was she just mentally unstable? What would be causing something like that? And that is, I think where we will, of course, launch into next. Once the police see this, how do they start to treat her? And is she, although she's covered in blood, is it any of it hers? Does she have any bruising or damage to herself, or is it all Stefan's blood that she's coated in?
Well, at first they didn't know. They really didn't know what was going on. She kept talking about Stefan having beaten her, but then they asked her, "Are you okay?" And she'd say, "Yes." And they'd say, "Are you hurt?" And she'd say, "No." The apartment, in the apartment, there's a really funny thing in the phone call, in the 911 call, Dave, where she's going on and on, and at times you can't understand her because she's been drinking and because her voice is kind of this growl almost on the phone. But at one point and the operator keeps saying, slow down, I can't understand you. At one point her voice becomes completely clear, and she says, "Be quiet." Well, the 911 operator doesn't know what's going on. She said, "Are you talking to me?" And Anna doesn't say anything. She goes back to that other voice. There's no one in the apartment with her but Stefan, and Stefan's dead. If the altercation was at 2:15 and she called at 3:30 or so, he's been dead for a considerable amount of time. So she thought she was talking to someone else in that apartment, but there wasn't anybody else there.
Wow. Are the police treating her like a victim, or are they treating her like a suspect at this point?
Well, at the beginning, they didn't know what they had. It was entirely possible. Domestic violence is horrible. It happens. And usually the woman is the victim. So we're all kind of programmed to think that if a woman says, "My husband was beating me up," we believe that he probably was. But in a certain number of cases, it is turned around the other way. So in the beginning, they really didn't know what they had, but they started looking at the crime scene. Well, first they brought her down and they sent her downtown to be interviewed by detectives, and then they started pulling apart the crime scene. Well, they found Stefan's hair, tufts of his white hair, on his black leather couch in the living room. They didn't find any of her hair anywhere. And they saw that the blood was all really low to the floor. Almost all of that blood spatter, and there was a lot of it, was within 2 to 3 feet of the floor, which meant that when Stefan was bleeding, when the person was bleeding, they had to be laying down on the floor. So there were just indications as they went through that maybe she wasn't telling the truth. And then when they started doing the interrogation downtown, she started talking about many people in her past, men who she said who had been abusive toward her. But when they asked her if Stefan had been abusive toward her, she couldn't come up with an example of anything he had done. Of course, then when the forensics came in, it became even more clear because none of the blood in the apartment was hers. None of the blood on her was her blood. They did, at one point, the people in the jail noted some fading bruises, but remember, she'd been beaten up by somebody else earlier. They didn't see anything fresh, and she didn't complain about anything.
Okay, so they're interviewing her about this. They're starting to see that there's inconsistencies in her story. She's contradicting herself, right? He was violent. He did this. Well, had this happened before? What other happened? She had no points of reference for them. Does she get to leave that police station, or do they end up keeping her in as now a suspect in this murder?
They kept her in. They asked her at one point, how was he abusive toward you, physically or psychologically? And she said psychologically. Here she is in the middle of this grisly murder, and she's not talking about physical abuse from him. So they listened to her story. Her story didn't make any sense. And it didn't match with what they were getting calls from the crime scene, and they were telling them what they were finding. And they booked her that night, or actually it was that morning. By then it was the next day.
How violent was this attack? I mean, did she just catch him right with the stiletto and catch him in the temple, and that's what caused the geyser of blood? Was it multiple impact zones? What exactly can you tell me about her style of attack?
Well, the medical examiner counted at least 25 wounds. From the heel, where she had come down with the heel of the shoe and hit Stefan mainly on the head, the face, and on the hands. She had no defensive wounds on her body at all, no bruising or anything on her arms from holding her hands up to protect herself. But he had defensive wounds all over his arms from putting his hands up to try to cover his face. And it appeared that he had tried to turn his face to the side to get away from her. They surmised that she must have been sitting across him, kind of straddling him, sitting across his chest. And that was why her jeans were so saturated with blood, because there was blood pouring out of the wounds in his head, and that made that blood pool on the carpet, and that transferred to her jeans.
Are they getting any impression that she's obviously, I mean, she's a liar at this point. They're picking up on that. But are they getting any other kind of mental disturbance vibe from her at all?
Well, they asked her, actually, at one point if she had ever been diagnosed with any mental illness, and she said no. And they said, do you have any mental issues or any psychiatric issues we should discuss? And she said no. And she had no history. You know, there was nothing documented. Could she, you know, there were things happening, but it wasn't, you know, she didn't have like a diagnosis of schizophrenia or something that might have added into this. So, and one of the oddest things was at the crime scene when they were going through her purse, they pulled out a tarot card book Anna was doing tarot cards with people. And as they pulled the tarot card book out of her purse, it was open to the death card.
Well, and now for people that know too, the death card doesn't always indicate death or murder.
No,
it can indicate
doesn't.
the transition of one time to another, her moving from where she was to a different place, or a job change, things like that. So, but it's certainly ominous and gives you a good Hollywood twist there, doesn't it?
It does. She had done something else that night too. She had told one of her friends earlier that evening. She handed him a couple of coins and told him to put it in his cupboard at home, and he kind of laughed at her and said, Anna, why would I do that? And she said, if you don't, something very bad is going to happen.
Interesting.
So there was something going on
right.
in her mind. This isn't, you know, they kind of foreshadowed this murder that night. So
now, obviously, you know, they've got her pretty much dead to rights. Does she ever admit that this was just an out-and-out murder? What is her excuse as court starts to loom and the idea of paying for these crimes?
She maintained what she did that first night in the 911 call, which was that he had attacked her, and he had come at her, and she described this attack, but it, as I said, it did not match the forensic evidence in the apartment at all. But she said that, and it started going out all over the world. I mean, this story got picked up. I was actually in London when this happened, and I was in a hotel room and turned on the TV, and the BBC had it on. And what they reported was that this was a woman who was, reported that she was in a domestic violence situation and struck out in self-defense. Everything I saw, everything that was reported in the early days and the early weeks, was that this was self-defense.
And how quickly did Stefan's family and friends start to step forward and say, this is not the man that we know?
Within a day. That Monday, when the assistant DA in charge of the case got into his office, there were phone calls from Stefan's friends all over the world who said, no, Stefan would not have done that. That's not what he was like. He wasn't that guy. And still at the beginning, you know, the DA didn't believe it. The assistant DA who handled it had a really hard time understanding why Stefan didn't fight back, you know, why he just laid there and took it. And, you know, it was just not who Stefan was. He was not going to fight back. I don't think he probably really understood how much trouble he was in until she had hit him quite a few times and he started to fall. And then at that point, I don't know that he had the strength to fight back.
The strength or wherewithal.
There's also a theory. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying the strength or the wherewithal, the conscious, at that point, he may have taken so many quick blows to the head that there was no making sense of what was going on in his world.
That's very possible. The other thing is when they did the autopsy, they found some bruising around his chest. They think that was from her sitting on him. And it was possible that the adrenaline rush was so big from what he was going through. I mean, Stefan was 59, that it may have caused some type of a cardiac event that exacerbated the situation and made it difficult for him to respond.
All right. The idea of possession, does the defense ever start to bring that up in this case? Or is it just because of the odd way she acted and her interest in the occult and the paranormal that started to make people question how she would end up doing something like this?
No, the defense didn't go there at all. I don't think they thought that it would help them. It didn't enter the courtroom except in that tarot card book. And one of the really interesting things was that she left all these notes behind. Remember I told you she was making those notes where she
right.
was drawing circles and... Well, on one of those notes that day, Dave, she had written out calling for a spirit to appear to her, somebody she called Christian. It was hard to read, but it was like Christian Levator or Christian Lever to appear. So, and she left odd things behind. There was this little teepee hut thing that was made out of woven wood. And I talked to a Santeria priestess in New Orleans and sent her a picture of it. And she thought that it was a spirit containment vessel, that when people would call spirits back, sometimes they would try to contain them within things. And she thought that that's what Anna was doing with it. So there were little indicators there, but it was almost as if nobody wanted to talk about it at the trial. The prosecutor brought up the tarot card book, but that was the extent of it. And the defense didn't go there. The defense tried to go with what Anna had said, which was that this was really purely self-defense. It really wasn't until
after... Right, and in a sense, they don't want to play up the possibility of her being crazy, I would guess, at this point, right? They're just trying to show it as a woman under duress and stress dealing with something horrific and negative.
Right, they were trying to say she was the victim, you know, and she just fought back. And yeah, she hit him 25 times with a stiletto heel that had a metal rod in it that was almost like hitting him with an ice pick. But she was reacting to what he had done. And, you know, she didn't realize, you know, how badly she was hurting him until he was actually already in a lot of trouble. So they were actually just trying to prove that it had been the reverse, that he had gone after her. They were kind of stuck with what she said in the recorded interview she'd done with police that first night. So, you know, and the other thing is that in Texas, the law is that unless you don't know the difference between right and wrong, mental illness is not a defense. Somebody drinking and then acting out, even though they've been influenced by the alcohol, well, that's not a defense in a murder case.
Right.
So she was not so psychologically impaired that she couldn't carry on a conversation, that she didn't know the difference between right and wrong.
How did you, when putting the story together, were you following it at the time, or was this something that you did much later? And did you get a chance to sit in front of Anna at any point?
Well, you know, I went to the, I always start out with the trial, so I went to the trial. It was really a fascinating trial. It went on for about 3 weeks. And, I met a lot of people there, and then after the trial, I started fanning out. I didn't know about this whole, about the spiritual aspect of this or the, you know, the things that Anna was delving into until the trial, and didn't get much of it until after the trial. One woman got up on the stand during the trial and said, this was during the punishment phase, a friend of Anna's who said she'd been afraid of Anna and she thought that Anna was stalking her dreams and that she had been having dreams of Stefan, and Stefan was asking her to clear his name, that he would never have done this. So that came out at the trial, but there was just a touch of it. And then as I started going around, at first people were really reluctant to talk about all of this aspect of it. But as I went back and interviewed people more and more, they started to kind of say, well, you know, there was this thing that she was doing. And then it started to come out. And once I knew about it and I knew to ask about it, then they would tell me. They would say, yeah, well, you know, once when she was at our apartment, she drew a pentagram on the floor out of salt and put candles on the corners of the star and sat next to it with her hands up and her eyes closed and chanted. And when we asked her what she was doing, she said, I'm driving the evil spirits out of your apartment. But it took a while. People were reluctant to talk about that aspect of her life.
Well, and that's understandable, right? I mean, they're, you know, they don't want to seem like they're nuts, too. And why wouldn't, you know, I guess in that situation, then, too, it kind of falls on to, well, why didn't you say something? Why wasn't this brought up more? You know, probably trying to deal with and avoid their own guilt for the situation that they're dealing in.
Well, a lot of them, especially that last few months when Anna was becoming progressively more violent, had seen things in her, and they had pulled away from her. And Anna had called a few of them when she'd been kicked out of that last apartment she was staying in, looking for some place to stay, and they had all turned her down. And the last one she called was Stefan, and he took her in.
Mm.
So I think some of them had a sense almost of guilt, you know, that
Survivor's guilt, right?
Happened, sure. And now look, but you know, of course, they shouldn't have. But we're human, and we do. We internalize these things.
Right.
So it was just there were a lot of emotions at play over it, and this aspect of it just made the whole thing so much stranger.
Yeah, the case, how quickly does it fold up once it's in court? How quickly do they come to the conclusion she did it, it wasn't self-defense, this was murder, and what was her penalty for all of this?
Well, you know, it's in the courtroom, this started to come together pretty quickly, and there wasn't really any contradicting evidence. The defense attorney, there were a couple of really amazing demonstrations in the trial. One was that the prosecutor, John Jordan, used a dummy and one of the stiletto heels and demonstrated how Anna had come down again and again and again with that heel onto Stefan's head and face that night in order to match the wounds that the medical examiner found. And a blood expert showed how he had to have been laying there on his back while that blood spatter was made, you know, that's the only way that pattern would have developed. On the other side, the defense attorney tried to put on a demonstration of how Stefan might have attacked Anna, and it could have explained what happened, but it didn't match the forensic evidence. It just didn't work.
Right.
But he tried hard. He brought in a martial arts guy to try to explain it. So she was convicted. And then they went through the punishment phase, and a lot of people came in to talk about what Anna had become. Now, remember, this is a woman who was a suburban housewife, mom, a working career woman who had a great job just like 4 or 5 years earlier. But the testimony at the trial was what she became during those last couple of years before the murder. And they talked about things they had seen, that the violence that they had seen in her at the end. So they, you know, it's really unusual for a woman in a murder case to get a life sentence. You know, we had the Susan Wright case here in Houston, which is the bloody mattress case where a woman stabbed her husband 95 times, and she got 20 years. But based on the testimony and what people saw in what Anna had become, she did get a life sentence.
Has she spoken to you regarding this book and your research?
No, she hasn't. I tried. I always go in. I've been in the prisons many times over the years. I always try to go in and interview the people afterward.
Mm-hmm.
I always ask, show me something that proves that you're innocent, if they're saying that they're innocent. And then I go out and try to investigate that. I mean, you never know. We do have innocent people in our prisons.
Right.
I mean, juries are wrong sometimes. Mm-hmm. We're all human. We make mistakes. So I did the same thing with Anna. I tried to go and interview her in prison, but I drove all the way there. But when I got there, they told me that she had changed her mind, decided not to talk to me. So I have not spoken with her. But I was in the courtroom when she testified, and I also watched her videotaped interrogation, which is, I think, 3 or 4 hours long. So I did get to hear what she had to say.
Do you think that all of this work with the spiritualist and conjuring affected her to do this murder? Do you believe that there was a case of possession involved here, or do you think that this was just a mentally broken woman?
I don't believe she was actually possessed. But I believe that she believed that she had contacted spirits. You know, like I said, in the middle of that 911 call, her voice clears up, becomes crystal clear for just that second, and she orders somebody in that apartment to be quiet. That note sitting there, you know, asking that spirit to appear to her.
Did they ever clarify that in any of the court proceedings? Who was that you were speaking to? Who did you tell to be quiet?
No, they just didn't go there. They brought in the...
Right, but you would think, okay, I understand not going there for the supernatural aspect, but if you're listening mm-hmm. to a phone call, you now know the man has been dead for at least an hour. You would think, is there a second person? Could this be how she overpowered him and was able to do this? I would think that that would have opened up a can of worms that they would have wanted to investigate of who was she speaking to.
Well, that night they had asked her if anybody else was in the apartment, and she said no. And this was a high security apartment building where they had videotape all over. So they knew nobody else had entered, and they needed a key card to get in. So nobody else had come in that apartment building that night during that time and gone up to the 18th floor. So they knew no one else was in there. So it never did become part of it. And it just didn't help the defense's case at all, mm-hmm. and the prosecutors didn't need it.
Interesting. I would have thought it might have, in a way. What a strange situation. Well, Catherine, I can't thank you enough for coming back and spending some time with us on our Return to True Crime Tuesday format this evening. What a chilling story. Have you got any new ones that you're starting to look into that you can tease us with?
Well, I've got a new book I just finished. I think it's coming out late this year. It's on the Kaufman County prosecutor murders, the ones up outside of Dallas. That's the one where the justice of the peace murdered the district attorney, his wife, and one of the other prosecutors. Happened back in 2013, made big headlines. They thought it was the Aryan Brotherhood at first, but it turned out to be this strange little justice of the peace who liked to play Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, we will have to revisit with you about that when that book becomes available, so please keep in touch with us on that. Hey, we're going to take a break, and then when we come back, our good friend Jason Gowan is going to join us as we take a look at Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals, the triumphant or not-so-triumphant return of Florida Man. We've got more coming your way. Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals here next on Beyond the Darkness, True Crime Tuesday. We're back. This is the triumphant return of True Crime Tuesday on Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis is still out ill. He'll be back with us next week for Parashare Supernatural News. And if you tuned in yesterday, you heard our good friend Jason Gowan joined us and spent a little bit of time having laughs and fun with us. Tonight, he's back for True Crime Tuesday, the Stupid Crimes and Dumb Criminals section of the show. And boy, when I think of dumb criminals, you're the first person that jumped to mind. So thank you for being here with us again, Jason.
Oh, no problem. I posted my own wanted poster all over your bathroom just so you would keep thinking of me.
Well, that's the only way to keep you in fresh in my mind. We've got a bunch of stories coming in this week, and I want to thank our listeners for pointing out some of these crazy tales. So let's get going. A person dressed in the suit of an extraterrestrial creature tried to escape from police in the city of Ufa. Law enforcement officers of Ufa had to detain the person in the suit. Eyewitnesses said that the alien entered a food store and scared all the salespeople in it. It turned out later that the alien was a member of a TV crew from Moscow. The crew arrived in the city to film an episode of a popular TV show in which they inspect food stores and assess levels of service. Boy, that sounds like a hot show. How come you haven't signed up for one of those here in the United States?
Oh, there's legal ramifications if I even try.
You're not allowed in alien costumes in grocery stores?
There was an incident in 92, and I've got it's a 20-year retainer on it.
Well, those crazy Russians. Okay, so this idea. We're going to go to grocery store, inspect food store to assess level of service. We'll be big hit. How can we make it better? I know. Put our guy in a costume like Alien. That's the big idea.
It's best to catch moose and squirrel.
The crew, including the person in the alien suit, were allowed to continue working. Meanwhile, Russian ufologists believe that representatives of extraterrestrial civilizations will be visiting the Earth more frequently in 2017. and encounters will be most frequent in Russia's Ural region, known as the M Triangle. The triangle is a territory between Sverdlovsk and the Perm regions. Unidentified flying objects appear in the area every 2 or 3 years. Nothing happens for the next 12 to 13 years, but the extraterrestrial activity then resumes. So that's the big weird, dumb crime coming out of Russia. I guess it's bad form to dress up as an alien and go in and harass the people of grocery stores while dressed as an alien.
On top of that, though, I guess it's best that they're checking their Ural region rather than the anal region.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, we're going to go all the way from Russia. We're going to go all the way around the world, Jason. So I hope you've brought your parka. We're heading to the stately state of Missouri. Are you ready for this one? This is a case I thought you would probably be wishing that you were on the reciprocate or on the receiving side of this very bizarre crime. We're going to Peavely, Missouri, where Brianna Wiley called the Peavely police last Friday night when she returned home with her two young boys to find a strange woman sitting on their couch. I asked her who she was and why she was there, and she told me her name was Catherine, and she said she was there for a birthday party, said Brianna Wiley, and she was definitely dressed for it. There was no birthday party, and the woman was stripped down to her birthday suit, wearing nothing but a smile. I had to ask her to let me into the house, and she put her clothes on backwards. Then she realized her clothes were on backwards, so she proceeded to take them off as I was standing there, Wiley said. Officers, who later arrived on scene and placed her in custody, advised that she was, I know this is going to be hard to believe, highly intoxicated, Jason.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, there's no way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's what Corporal Benjamin Litterall of the Peavely Police Department had to share. This isn't the first time the woman has crashed someone's home drunk. How soon are you going to be moving to Missouri knowing this woman's walking around looking to party in the nude?
It was Peavely, you said?
Peavely, Missouri.
I'm going to pull up Zillow real quick and see what we're looking at for the housing market.
Well, I think with this woman in the area, it's going to either really crash or it's going to start burning up. The woman identified as Catherine Thorell was charged Wednesday for crashing into another Peavely home back in February. Peavely police said that said in that incident, Thorell narrowly missed hitting a mother and a child sitting in the living room watching TV. Authorities said her blood alcohol level was 3 times the legal limit. Now, Thorell was charged with driving while intoxicated, persistent offender, and second-degree property damage with a $10,000 bond. For the Wileys, the damage is all mental. Her 4 and 6-year-old boys can't stop talking about the incident.
Are they going to take her in for show and tell?
I'm here for the birthday party. Mom, for me? Now that's all we hear about is the naked lady. And including at school, school gets to hear about the naked lady too, Wiley said.
Oh, I am sure that they are. Can just imagine they're like,
today for show and tell, I brought in the naked birthday party lady.
Oh my God. The balls of some people, really. I'm going to head into this birthday party. First of all, how did she
balls
get into the
tits.
House?
I was more like a tits thing.
Yeah. How do you get into the house? Just sit there naked waiting for the party. I guess that's the Missouri way. You can't question it.
Well, the other thing is, who is inviting her to all these parties?
I think it's you. Have you been sending out invitations to people to try to get them to show up to parties and just so you can see what the aftermath is on the news?
Yeah, well, I'm a big chance encounter on Craigslist kind of guy. I just put ads out and see what happens.
Chance encounter. You, naked in my living room for a party that wasn't there. Me, wishing I would have had a chance to see you again. Oh, God.
Intoxicated a plus.
Yes. I've got a couple of stories here. Before we take a dive into Florida, which I know you're familiar with, let's take a look at some of the other stupid stories and dumb criminals from around the world. Here's a good one. We're going to go to Indiana for this one. A Columbus man was arrested Friday after police found him walking naked and yelling gibberish on US 31. He was looking for the damn party. He was a couple states over. It should have been Missouri. Is that where he was heading, you think?
Yeah, it's a couple days walk. He was heading in the right direction.
Walking around nude, yelling. Officers were originally sent to the 3100 block of Dale Court at around 4:18 p.m. to investigate a report of a person entering a garage. On their way there, police learned the man, later identified as 26-year-old Sterling A. Wessel, had taken off all of his clothes and headed toward a Kroger marketplace. Where's my damn alien suit? Police say an officer attempted to stop Wessel while he was walking in front of Kroger, and Wessel resisted. So the officer took him to the ground. Oh, asphalt burn. Oh, my God. Oh, Wessel, who was believed to be under the influence, I know another holy cow minute. Wessel, who was believed to be under the influence of an unknown substance, was taken to the hospital for medical clearance. He was then taken to the Bartholomew County Jail and charged with residential entry, public nudity, disorderly conduct, and resisting law enforcement.
To me, the last name Wessel sounds like an 18th century, like, proper English judge, and that he was just contesting whatever he was saying.
Oh, Judge Wessel.
I am Thurston Wessel the Third.
All right. Now, I got to be honest, knowing you for as many years as I have, I was kind of astonished that this next story did not include your name.
I can't wait.
We're going to Pittsburgh.
You're even in the state.
Yeah. A man whose company scoops up pet poop has been placed on probation for 2 years and fined for $500 for buying fake Secret Service identification cards and badges online to impress women on a dating site. Oh, well, when you are a professional shitter picker upper, I guess that doesn't always lead the ladies on plenty of fish to your door.
No, weird. You'd think that'd be enough. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, you see here, I'm a Secret Service agent. I'm currently undercover, picking up dog poop. That's just what I do. This is my real job. I'm actually a secret agent.
We're looking for packets of heroin hidden cleverly inside packets of dog poop. Christopher DiOrio, 54, of Greensburg, was sentenced Monday by a federal judge in Pittsburgh. He pleaded guilty in November to fraudulently using an official seal, but acknowledged behavior in two other counts dismissed on Monday, flashing an ID card during a traffic stop and trying to use a Secret Service badge to get a government rate for a hotel room. And how much is the room? It'll be $109. I'm with the Secret Service. What can we do now? $106, sir. Your Honor, I'm not a bad man. I'm just a dumb man, DiOrio told U.S. District Judge Noah Barry Fisher. What I did was truly stupid, and I'm very sorry for that. Defense attorney William Defenderer. Oh, come on. That can't be his name.
That cannot be his real name.
It's D-I-F-E-N-D-E-R-F-E-R. William Defenderer. Sounds like a really lame superhero. Said that he was very happy with the sentence, which, among other things, will enable DiOrio to continue helping his widowed mother care for his disabled sister and continue in counseling to save his marriage. Oh, my God, this is like a country song gone bad. Widowed mom, disabled sister. He's got a wife.
What's this? Is there a picture of the sister?
He's using the Secret Service card to try to get laid. Oh, God. Oh, my God. DiOrio's wife.
I'm curious to know how cheap he is that he lives, that he, like, was Expedia broken that day?
Oh, my God. DiOrio's wife, who is not in court, is one of the women he met online while holding himself out as a Secret Service agent. So he won her hand. What does she think he is when he comes home and grass stains on his knee and smells like poop? It was a rough day, baby. A lot of anal checks. We got to make sure nobody's smuggling weapons of mass destruction.
Well, honey, today we dealt with a lot of them people who've been pooping balloons.
Pooping balloons. The investigation began when police in Pittsburgh suburb of a reserve township said DiOrio flashed a Secret Service ID card when an officer pulled him over for a faulty brake light.
The hotel incident occurred a month earlier. How do you think that's going to get you out of a faulty tail light? Just tell the officer I'm going to go stop by Pep Boys and fix it on the ride home.
It's he had to like, stop by his secret underground headquarters and get the light changed.
Come on, secret squirrel. I'm on the way back to headquarters. Q's going to take care of that for me right now. Oh, my God.
They don't usually just give you a warning and tell you to come get it checked out. They don't even usually write you a ticket for
that's
that.
That's my point. How stupid are you? DiOrio told the officer he was a Secret Service agent who had just returned from the Republican National Convention. The Republican National Convention in Cleveland. His credentials said DiOrio was a senior special agent in the Protective Services Division. And upon further investigation, authorities learned that DiOrio's first and last name just happened to match those of a real Secret Service agent who DiOrio has never met. Assistant.
What? That's like a Kevin James movie, Waiting to Heaven.
It is. Or Paulie Shore returned to the big screen. Assistant U.S. Attorney Paul Hull told the judge that the case was especially troubling because DiOrio owned several weapons and passed himself off as a protective agent in a presidential campaign year. What we hope by bringing this
case... Is this a website you have the IDs from? Because I would like to go order my own.
I don't know. You have to choose between the Secret Service or the Fox Mulder FBI one. Or the Elvis Presley special FBI card. Oh, my God. Okay, here it goes. DiOrio told investigators he bought the IDs and badges for $100 online back in March of 2014, when he also began to identify himself as a federal agent on online dating sites and his former Facebook page. In reality, DiOrio owned and operated Doodle Scoopers. A very successful business in the Pittsburgh suburb of Bethel Park, and a second business that sells gourmet home-baked treats for dogs. Oh, my God. So
he's got the kind with the pea-flavored sprinkle.
I'm sorry, my dog prefers a biscuit that smells like my neighbor's dog's ass. Have you got anything like that? DiOrio had also begun buying handguns and rifles, one that looked like those used to equip Secret Service agents. DiOrio had to surrender the weapons because he pleaded guilty to a felony. Authorities haven't named the Chinese company that created and sold the credentials. Oh my God. How can that be?
I don't know. I'm on eBay right now, and you can get one that's pretty convincing for $84.95.
Jason, it is terrifying. It is a terrifying world we live in. Let's go one more before we hit Florida, all right? We're going to go to Sandusky, Ohio.
Oh, no.
Police say a couple in Ohio staged a murder scene in a bathtub in which they poured ketchup over her and then sent pictures to friends saying he did it. Sandusky officers showed up after getting calls Thursday night from three people police say were hysterical. That's when officers discovered that the scene in the couple's bathtub had been staged. Police say Natalie Schlett and Micah Reisner are charged with inducing panic. I didn't even know that's a thing. You, welcome to the people's
court. I could have had my ex-mother-in-law arrested like three times then.
Inducing panic? My God. The IRS induces a lot of panic. How come they're not getting charged? Both pleaded not guilty on Friday. Not guilty. Police Sergeant Don Allen tells the Sandusky Register that while it might have been funny to the couple, it wasn't a joke to the police. The couple couldn't be reached for comment. No telephone numbers were listed for them. Court records didn't indicate whether they have an attorney or not. Oh, my God.
And they're also all out of ketchup.
Here's the deal. So do you think this is what the guy's got planned? Micah faked Natalie's death, right? So now he can really wipe her out and nobody's going to believe it. All that Micah, he's back up to his hijinks.
Micah!
All right. Well, folks, I've been holding it off as long as we can. One of our favorite highlights on True Crime Tuesday, Stupid Crimes, Dumb Criminals, is... going to Florida because there is an abundance of dumb people in Florida.
Boy, is there.
A Cape Coral man told police he was delivering drugs to friends in Key West in exchange for a free vacation before being pulled over for speeding in Marathon on Tuesday. Tyler Deutsch, 21, was stopped just before 8 p.m. for going almost twice the speed limit near mile marker 48, according to the arrest report from Monroe County Sheriff's Deputy Matthew Corey. Dodge told Corey he was aware of warning signs that the 35-mile-per-hour limit is strictly enforced in the area and was on his way to Key West for vacation. After Corey smelled marijuana and told Dodge he was going to search the 2008 Buick LaCrosse, he noted in the report that Deutsch began to develop beads of sweat on his forehead. This is not normal behavior since the outside temperature was near 75 degrees. I have a protective vest on and long pants, and I was not sweating, Corey wrote. Deutsch was wearing a tank top and shorts on the same evening. I conducted three other traffic stops, and none of those drivers appeared to be sweating. During the search, Corey wrote he found a black backpack with an 84.5 grams, that's about 3 ounces of marijuana, in plastic bags. Underneath the divider between the trunk bottom and the spare tire was a glass jar, inside of which were 318 ecstasy pills with smiley faces stamped on both sides. Wow, that's a that's customer service. That's going the extra mile. Not just putting a smiley face on one side, but putting them on both.
As soon as you started telling the story, the Partridge Family theme song started playing in my head.
Why? Come on, kid. Happy.
Come on, kid. Happy.
Deutsch said his friends forgot the drugs on the mainland, and in exchange for the delivery, they'd pay for his entire trip. He also told Corey he'd smoke some of the marijuana before the drive. Little do they know, the trip up the river is going to be very expensive. When asked to rate it from 1 to 10, he advised that it was an 8. Corey wrote of the pot's quality. He advised that the cannabis was usually sold for around $200 an ounce. Deutsch was arrested for possession of marijuana with intent to sell, possession of more than 20 grams of marijuana, possession of 10 grams or more of fentanyl, which is also known as ecstasy, and use of paraphernalia to transport drugs, all felonies. He was also ticketed for speeding. There's the cherry on top. Deutsch was transported to the jail in Marathon without bond.
Oh, so he can't even finish the delivery.
Right. So that's like straight out of a cop movie, right, where he starts getting the beads of sweat on the forehead and the cop realizes what's going on. This guy's like a super cop.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, I'm not sure that I agree with the cop, because I sweat when it's like 40 degrees and it's just lightly sunny out, so that I don't think that's a good way. But I mean, he was obviously right, but I sweat when it, you know, in a blizzard.
Right. I do too. I'm sweating right now in a cold place.
What do you got in the bag, Schrader?
Nothing. Just keep moving. All right, let's get a couple more of these done. You know, we can't just beat up on Florida man. Let's talk about Florida woman. Florida woman throws needles into the backseat with child during a traffic stop, police say. Oh, Boca Raton, Florida. Police officers in Florida said they found three hypodermic needles within arm's reach of a toddler Tuesday afternoon during a traffic stop. When a woman in the vehicle was asked how this could happen, she said she panicked when she saw the patrol car's emergency lights and threw the needles in the back seat, according to a Boca Raton police report. Christine Meyer, 31, of Okeechobee, told the officer it was a panicked, stupid mistake, police said. She remained in the Palm Beach County Jail early Thursday on $3,000 bail on charges of child neglect and possession of drug equipment. So what I'm curious about, I'm dying here, laughing so hard tonight, but why is it that if you're doing illegal drugs or drinking, why are you keeping them out in plain view, ever? Why aren't the needles, like, tucked into the seat or under, you know, in that little space in between the seats?
You can't get a good fix from in there, Dave. If you can't shoot up while you're driving from in there.
I don't know. I've never done it. I don't know. Maybe you're right. But it just seems a lot of these idiots should have thought this through a little bit more. You know, you just grab the needles and outlining the kid in the back seat like a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
The kid's got the apple on his head. She's lucky she didn't pierce like his little juice box or something.
Pardon me? I don't think you're allowed to do that.
She pulled a hole in his Capri Sun, David.
Oh my God! How old do you have to be to get your juice box pierced in Florida?
Oh, they start giving them out at 5.
Oh God.
I lived right in Boca Raton, and that's like a normal everyday practice there.
Well, since we're talking about injections, this headline, this might win the day for me. All right, pull it together, Dave. We can do this. Miami-Dade man charged with giving illegal butt injections that left a woman in the hospital. Are there legal butt injections?
Oh, yeah. They Botox the shit out of stuff down there.
A Miami man was arrested on charges of providing illegal butt injections that left a woman in the hospital. I'm sorry. The victim told Miami-Dade police she went to Carlos Gilberto Mendoza's West Miami-Dade home for unknown injections all over her body from May 2016 to February. She spent $4,300 on injections to her face and butt. Medical records show Carlos Mendoza, 49, I know this is going to be hard to believe, is not a licensed doctor. On Tuesday, the victim was hospitalized for complications from the injections. Police found Mendoza at his home, plus a cache of lidocaine, Botox, and bacitracic, what is it? Bacitracic water, which is used to dilute medications for injections. He was arrested and charged with performing medical procedures without a license and illegally possessing prescription drugs with the intent to sell. So the irony of this case, this man is going to go get a lot of illegal butt injections in jail. Oh, it's the circle of life. Oh, Carlos, what were you thinking, my friend?
Oh,
all right.
Now I picture holding Carlos up over the other prisoners as they chant and that song plays.
Oh, all right. Trying to pull it together. Boynton man accused of biting Publix customer while stealing meat. This sounds like a weird sex fetish in Florida. A Boynton Beach man was arrested Saturday after he allegedly attacked two people at a Publix supermarket and left a bite mark on one victim while stealing about $110 worth of meat, according to an arrest report. Darian Gianelli is facing charges of robbery, aggravated assault on a victim 65 or older, and theft after he allegedly tried to walk out of the Publix in the Sunshine Square Shopping Center at Federal Highway and Woolbright Road with $110.04 of meat in a handbasket without paying. Gianelli, 23, was being held Tuesday morning in the Palm Beach County Jail in lieu of a $1,000 bail. Gianelli allegedly pushed a female employee who tried to stop him as he made his way out of the store. A 65-year-old man intervened and struggled with Gianelli when Boynton Beach police arrived. Gianelli tried to run away, but was quickly taken into custody, the report said. The 65-year-old victim had punctures in his right hand as the result of getting bitten by Gianelli. Gianelli told police he bit the guy because he was freaking choking me, the report said. The pilfered meat... That was the name of your band in the 80s, wasn't it? The Pilfered Meat was returned to the store.
That was Lesbo Nips.
The Pilfered Meat was returned to the store undamaged, police said. Can they sell that, do you think?
If it's still packaged, it's probably. As long as he didn't bite the meat, they should be okay.
Nice meat. It's still. Your package is very nice. All right, another Florida woman in the news today. Getting a tattoo on spring break seems like a great idea until your credit card gets declined and the shop owner comes after you with a social media squad. That was the reality Andrew Villanova, 22, faced on his vacation in Key West. The Florida Keys News reported Villanova got a $200 tribal shark tatted on his calf, but left the shop, Southernmost Tattoo, on Saturday without paying, Florida Keys News reported. Well, first of all, did you expect a douchebag getting a tribal shark tattoo on his calf to pay?
You should have asked up front, because that's a good way to lose it right there. Right,
exactly. Wait, you want what? I'm going to need to get paid up front. Tribal shark. Hey, and before you start writing in angry expletive emails, I have a tribal dragon on my arm, so I know what it means to be a douchebag asking for that tattoo. He posted his new ink on Instagram, which the shop owner saw and commented, "Bring your punk ass back to my shop and pay for your freaking tattoo." Jamie Snedeker, the shop owner, and her followers allegedly threatened him on social media and, even worse, contacted his father. Eventually, Villanova paid up. "Don't tell my dad." He told Snedeker his car got declined and left looking for an ATM, but panicked and never came back, according to text messages.
Wait, so he attempted to pay for it. His card was declined.
Right.
And so he just took off.
And they said, no, he went out to go find an ATM. Duh. What would you do?
Right, yeah, but he intended to pay for it in the beginning, and then he panicked.
I guess. I don't. He's a spring breaker. He knew how much money he had left on his card. Finally, let's wrap up with a Florida man story I don't necessarily want to tell, but I feel that we've got to be fair to both law and lawbreakers. Recently hired Miami police officer was arrested Friday after he allegedly stole from drivers that he pulled over. Jose Acosta faces charges for armed burglary and armed grand theft, the Miami Herald reports. He was on the force for less than a year, according to the Miami Police Department. Police allege Acosta would pull over drivers and scare them before seizing their belongings. He was caught in a sting operation and is currently relieved of duty without pay, according to the Herald. So see, there are dumb criminals, and in this case, you've got the dumbest when it's your own law enforcement guys doing this stuff. What a shame. What a funny, weird, twisted shame.
It's a ballsy move.
It is. Jason, that's it for our time together. Man, I've had a great time. Thanks for sitting in with me these couple of nights.
Oh, thanks for having me, buddy. I really enjoyed it.
It's been a blast. Tomorrow, folks, again, let me just run it down for you. No more Jason Gowan. He's now on work release. I'm letting him out of his debt to society. He no longer has to do our show. Tomorrow, A Paranormal Life, Good, the Bad, and the Aliens. MJ Myers joins us on Thursday. We're going to talk about spooky Southern haunts, Savannah haunts with Chris Allen. And Friday, The Extra Dimensionals, True Tales of Alien Visitors. John D'Souza, a former FBI agent. I wonder if he got his ID card online from a Chinese place.
I just ordered mine.
You should. I want to see it. Make sure you post it when you get it up there. That's what's going on for this week. And remember, I'm going to also be hosting Coast to Coast AM, unless they listen to tonight's show. That might be off. I'm not sure. But I'll be back on Coast to Coast AM this Saturday, hosting from midnight till 4 a.m. Sunday morning. So for more information and stations in your area, go check out coasttocoastam.com/stations. You'll be able to find all the stations in and around your world to find out how you can listen to the show. Or you can always tune in at knsiradio.com. That's the station I use right here in St. Cloud, Minnesota to produce and bring out all the episodes of this show and of the Coast to Coast episodes. So make sure that you go check out knsiradio.com and send the management a thank you card for letting us do the show there. It's always a pleasure. But you can stream the show and listen to Coast AM live right from their site. Speaking of Coast to Coast, check it out tonight. Our buddy George Norrie has constitutional lawyer specializing in food and drug law. Jonathan Emmert is the only attorney in history that has defeated the Food and Drug Administration 7 times in federal court. He'll update his work on the many issues relating to vaccines, including state medical boards retaliating against physicians who speak out against vaccination, as well as changes happening in Washington, D.C. regarding the FDA, followed by open lines. That's later on tonight on the Best in Overnight Talk Radio with George Norrie. That's Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed tonight's True Crime Tuesday return. We'll try to do more of these and have more fun along the way. Special thanks to our guest, Jason Gowan, for being here with us this evening, and also to Catherine Casey for Possessed, the infamous Texas Stiletto Murders. We'll be back again tomorrow with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.